Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. My name is Larry Mishkin. I'm your host today, and we have some special news on the show. One of our recurring guests and a guy who we always like to have on because he's just a lot of fun to talk to has graciously agreed to join Jim, Marty, and I on a fairly permanent basis, maybe with a little rotation through the three of us. We'll see. But Rob Hunt, welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. As one of us, we're glad to have you on board.
Thanks, Larry. I'm super excited to be here as a host. It's super cool.
Well, good. For our listeners who haven't had a chance to listen to Rob yet, he brings a vast amount of knowledge both in cannabis and the dead, a little bit of a businessman's edge to it as well. So very well-rounded viewpoints we can give you here with Jim Marty, who's not with us today. He's traveling back from a client's facility in Oregon, so he's in the air right now. But Jim says to say hello, and of course Jim is with Bridge West Consulting and Accounting, and they do a lot of work in the cannabis space. I'm with the Hoban Law Group, also with a lot of work in the cannabis space, and Rob is in the cannabis space, so he has a lot of opportunity to do stuff there too. As we head into our show today, we do have some guests, but before we dive over there, I think it's worth noting that just a few hours ago, at least for our time here, not when everybody listens to this show, but as we record it, just a few hours ago, we had a quote-unquote peaceful transition of power in this country. Donald Trump has departed the premises, and Joe Biden is now in charge. You know, other than those who see this as a fresh start for America and, quite frankly, a breath of fresh air, on this show, we try to keep our politics more or less limited to the world of cannabis and the impact it has on this. And Rob, let's get you started with a nice question here. What's your impression on what this new administration means to cannabis in the United States?
That's a great question, a really open-ended question. And I think that it's worth noting, Larry, that not only did the change of the guard happen at the White House, but as we're talking right now, we've got Alex Padilla, Raphael Warnock, and John Ossoff getting sworn in as three new senators, all on the Democratic side, which means that probably by the time the show is finished recording, we'll have a 50-50 tie in the Senate as of today, which I thought might take a few weeks longer. So we now officially have a Kamala Harris as a tie-breaking vote in the Senate, and we now have new Senate appointments as far as new chairs, which means that it's a completely, completely different world in cannabis than it was this morning. So I think we're looking at probably a compressed timeline towards federal legalization. I don't think it's something that happens in the first 100 days of the Biden administration, but I certainly think right now that we have a real chance to see some major pieces of legislation make it out of the House and actually into the Senate, where they'll actually get a hearing, committees they're assigned to, and certainly end up getting a Senate floor vote. And if they do, I think we have a willing and able president to sign those bills into law. And I think we have an attorney general now in Merrick Garland, or soon to be Merrick Garland, who isn't going to stand in the way Jeff Sessions or a Bill Barr would. And so it's a great time in cannabis.
It is. And, it's just amazing to be able to sit here and talk about all of these things instead of imagining what they would be like, and to know that it is now our reality. And although Jim and I don't always see eye to eye on politics, one of the things that we like to take note of is how marijuana is the great unifier in this country. And everybody talks about this message of unity. And in this last election, with all the close votes and everyone talking about fraud and someone's really coming down to the wire in Florida, Georgia, we had the runoffs. The marijuana proposals all passed by large margins in every state where they came up. And that included South Dakota and Mississippi. So we're not just cherry picking some nice, green blue states here. These are you don't get much more conservative than South Dakota and Mississippi. And the fact that those measures easily passed by 20 or 30% margins in those states really speaks to the fact that this country is ready to be a pro cannabis country. I know there's a couple of big bills that have been passed in the House and have been just waiting to get on into the Senate for consideration. And Mitch McConnell, for his own reasons, has been a doorkeeper who hasn't been very willing to let really anything sponsored by the Democrats, let alone these types of bills, come through. And to me, the exciting point is that if a guy like Chuck Schumer says, yeah, let's move this through committee, let's get this out on the floor for a vote, I think that this is not a Democrat-Republican vote. I think this is a vote that pretty much goes pretty heavily in favor of pro-marijuana and, whatever topics they decide to address and bring out at that time, can only be good for the industry and for those of us that enjoy cannabis.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I think that, you know, for the first time now, the industry is looking at this and thinking to themselves, is this going to happen faster than we had calculated? And from a business standpoint, you know, what does that mean for us? And what does that mean for, you know, the potential big business coming in? And I think that, you know, for those of us who have been, you know, on the advocacy side for, you know, going on 30 years for me now, it's really tough to see, like, you know, for the first time, I'm really seeing what I believe is to be the light at the end of the tunnel. But on the other side of it is it happening in some ways too fast? Because, you know, now there's such opportunity. And if you look to what's happened on Wall Street in the last 2 weeks, you know, north of $2 billion has been raised into cannabis companies on private deals. You know, every day there's an announcement of another one. You know, Harborside raised $27 million yesterday, and TerrAscend raised $224 million. Curaleaf raised $300 million. Trulieve just did a huge raise. Juicy just did a huge raise. You know, across the board, the appetite right now for cannabis is massive, based on the sentiment, you know, that came forward after the Georgia runoffs. But we're in a place now where, you know, everyone's shoring up their balance sheets, and they're ready to start moving to try to consolidate this industry. And I think there's a lot of small players that have been in this that now are trying to figure out what to do, because it's inevitable now. You know, the walls of prohibition are crumbling.
They are. It's exciting to see, and it's exciting to be a part of it while it's happening. You know, kind of be living through history. And talking about people in the industry who might really help carry us forward, we do have some guests on our show today. Who I'd like to introduce, Brian Fields and Kellen Finney from Eighth Revolution. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Why don't you each give us you know, some quick background on yourselves in terms of how you managed to get into the cannabis space, how it is you're working with each other, and please tell us you know, very quickly, and our listeners, about Eighth Revolution.
Yeah, awesome. I think I'll go first. First off, thank you guys for having us on. It's a pleasure. Excited to talk about the dead and cannabis for sure. So I'm Kellen Finney. Got into the industry 6 years ago out in California after I finished up my graduate degree in chemical engineering. Went out and got involved with a startup in the medicinal market out in California's cannabis market. And we're doing CO2 extraction. Was able to stay with that company for about 3 years and got to see it go rec, adult use come online, which was really exciting. Then it kind of reached a point where I was just looking for a change of scenery, and they wanted to kind of stay small, like you were just talking about, Rob, and was looking to kind of advance my career, and took a position in Washington with a vertically integrated company at that point. Really large, got to handle a bunch of material hands-on, and then again, kind of reached a ceiling and wanted to control my own destiny. And I was fortunate enough, kind of in that transition, to link up with Brian here. And we were able to start Eighth Revolution. I'll let Brian kind of give a little bit about background about himself now.
So my background's a little different. I appreciate you guys having us on.
Sure.
My approach was marketing and technical business development, where I worked for a scientific instrumentation company where our focus was on quality control. And I was tasked roughly 3 years ago with entering the cannabis market, as obviously what was going on was kind of a developing market. And one of the first approaches was to attend MJ BizCon with a focus of understanding, you know, what type of technology is being used from a quality control standpoint and how could it benefit the space. And at that event, Kellen and I linked up as he was speaking at the Science Symposium, and we saw really clearly from a scientific approach on the need to implement sensors and the ability to kind of control the manufacturing process to deliver a consistent quality product over and over again, and kind of set out on this journey to kind of add value to the space. And Eighth Revolution, for what we are, where we provide services to the space, everything from capital to cannabinoids. So anything from helping with a biz deck to building it out through the process of walking through the license and the floor plan, through selecting the equipment, all the way through optimization and distribution. And at the end of the day, what we do best is we're quick moving, we're problem solvers. Kellen and I, there's not this big red tape of a large organization. You need help. And most of the time when we get those phone calls, there's clients in needs and they need help right away. And what we do best is we pivot and we move right to answers and to moving forward. And I think that's really the strongest benefit that we bring to the table.
Okay. What size entities do you typically work with? Are you working like with the really, really big entities? Do you work with smaller business people? What's your primary market?
I think we're all over the place. We're for the most part, we're on the more of the small to medium term type clients. But one of the biggest areas that we've been seeing in the last, I would say, 6 to 10 months is clients outside of the cannabis space that have kind of associative products that are interested in kind of migrating into the space, kind of dipping their toe into the water. So they're understanding where in the supply chain does our products add value? What are the pain points that are going on? Can you help us integrate this? And can you accelerate our timeline, as it seems like the cannabis industry is, which is constantly evolving and accelerating every single day? And how do we position ourselves to obtain this ever-growing market share?
Where do you guys see the technology and the capabilities in the extraction side of this business going? In other words, I mean, I'll tell you, I'm the old guy in the room, and back when when I was first getting turned on to cannabis, that's all there was. Every now and then, if you were lucky, some guy showed up with some hashish or whatever. Now, and I can remember the first time I saw anything at all that was even close to being like extraction at a wedding in Vermont with some guys up there who were way ahead of their time. And so for me, it already seems like, this is so hip and modern, and we're on a cutting edge. And then we come up with live resin and sugars. And where do we go with this? What's the next logical step in terms of extraction and what we can do to unlock, secrets and mysteries of the marijuana plant that we haven't seen yet?
Yeah, so I think where extraction's going is I like to think of Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, right? Where he has that machine that literally takes the tree and then turns it into the whatchamacallit at the end of it, right? And so that's probably where extraction's going right now, in terms of the massive interest in the terpenes and these other minor cannabinoids, right? That's only going to continue to grow and proliferate. So I see more and more separation technology being applied to the industry, and understanding exactly how to optimize getting the true essence of the plant into a derivative product, right? And that's why your live resins and a lot of those hydrocarbon products are so popular, is because they do the best job right now of capturing the entire essence of the plant, at least from a THC and cannabis side of things, right?
Do you think that's going to stay like with fractional distillation, or do you think it's going to go with something that's more technical than that to actually, separate salts out from cannabinoids, and then, separating out different isolates and distillates so everything is completely moved, or do you think that fractional distillation or wet film distillation are going to be kind of the technologies we're going to see going forward?
So I don't think that fractional distillation or white film distillation is going to be the answer for purification of kind of your minor cannabinoids, and as well as the terpenes. There's just and when I was doing it in practice, I mean, there could be some future developments that change the space, but the exposure of like all your monoterpenes to that kind of kinetic energy, even if it is really low for those white film distillations, I think it alters the true profile that the plant is producing naturally, right? And so I think that realistically, you're going to see more of chromatography kind of applied in line to the extraction techniques. It's going to be a cheaper solution in the long run, I imagine, from an economic standpoint, and it's going to provide a more robust separation of those different chemicals in line, right? And then it also plays into kind of your traditional manufacturing space of continuous flow manufacturing, so just feed it as much as you can and keep it running.
Right now in Illinois, one of the big things that's really starting to come out, which was part of the adult use statute when it was passed, is the right for people who are medical patients to do home grow. And I get a lot of calls from people who say, look, I'd love to do home grow, but I don't have any idea really how to grow. So it's become a little bit of a cottage industry here to find people with cultivation skills who, are willing to go into people's homes and kind of show them how to set up. But my impression of that is, and what I've seen from cultivation and grows, it's just simply a matter of going out and buying, whatever growing equipment you need. And if you wanted to grow tomatoes in your house or something like that, it really wouldn't be any different. Are we going to see a point in time where the technology for making extracts becomes simple enough that it can be done by the average person in their house? Or is it always going to require somebody, you know, like your guys like yourselves with a little more knowledge and experience to be able to do it not just safely, but efficiently and really, you know, generate the good stuff, let's say?
Almost like a French press, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, more and more. I mean, the thing that I think of is the 3D printers. My brother's in business, and one of his companies bought one of the very first 3D printers, you know, 20, 25 years ago. It was a big, huge machine. And, you know, they had to get a big loan, you know, to be able to buy it. And, but at the time, it was cutting edge, you know. But within a few years, there were smaller machines. And now you can literally do 3D printing on your desk, right? So I'm just wondering whether the technology of extraction can follow in that way, where it can get to a point where, you know, literally somebody can just shove their weed in here, plug it in there, you know, do a few things and sit back. The green light goes on, you pull out the tray and, you know, you have your extract.
I think likely, right? I think, you know, as the industry evolves and a need kind of becomes of that, think about if you're making a pizza at home and you wanted to put a little pesto with a little special something extra on there, how amazing that would be. Or for example, at my friend's house, he made it in a chicken wing sauce, which was incredible. But at the same time, like, that to me is, as the industry evolves, and it doesn't have to just be the flour, it doesn't have to just be the brownie or the edible. It can be in multitude of forms. And I think as the industry evolves and people become a little less with the stigma and stuff like that, and kind of take it in from a different approach, it has endless opportunities, especially from a home sense.
Well, I would agree with that. And I mean, when, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, because my knowledge is always, I find, you know, falling just a few steps behind my teenagers. But oil is the big thing these days, right? Especially for people who want to cook. Now, you can buy the cannabis oil, so you're not dealing with flour, you're not dealing with the grit of ground up weed like we had to deal with back in the day. You know, it's basically an oil that can just be blended right in, you know, with whatever you're cooking. So, you know, the question is, and I, you know, do we see a big surge of pre-measured amounts of cooking oil that people can buy, like a box of whatever, you know, I'm going to cook today, I'm going to take this, pour it in. Now I know I've got a good dose for making my lasagna tonight for dinner or whatever I'm making. Can it become that consumer friendly?
I think so. Yeah,
I hope so. And not only do I mean, it's been a little bit since I've cooked down some of the flour we're talking about. I think it was low and slow, but it's been a little bit. But conceptually, the idea of maybe, you know, growing your own flour and then taking it through the process to putting it in there is the same concept as the tomatoes. And I think it'll just be kind of looked at very similar and probably in a little more time than it should, in my opinion. But conceptually, I think we're on that route of just kind of putting it next to the basil leaf and incorporating it into your cooking.
So I know that you guys spend a fair amount of time thinking about minor or trace cannabinoids, and you know the trend obviously in the industry is moving away from THC Delta 9 as kind of being the primary focus of cannabinoids. We obviously saw, you know, CBD have a huge sort of pop about 4 years ago. That's now, you know, largely bifurcated the industry between hemp and THC based cannabis. But now we're seeing a lot of interest in, you know, the Varen series. We're seeing THCV starting to pop. But we're really seeing THC Delta 8 start to pop. And there's a lot of interest from a legal standpoint of, you know, whether or not you can ship THC Delta 8 across state lines, you know, how it's produced, whether it's produced from CBD as a cannabinoid that you create essentially through adding a catalyst and then coming out with D8 as your end result. And really, what the DEA's ruling on that was when they put out their interim final rule in August of last year. And what we can expect going forward with, you know, a new attorney general that's looking at this, and, you know, a new head of the DEA obviously coming forward as well. So just, you know, some thoughts on kind of what you guys see broadly about trace cannabinoids, and then more specifically, you know, kind of what you're seeing with the with D8 right now.
Yeah. So as far as the minors go, I think a group out of Italy last week just published an article that they discovered another 6 or 7 minor cannabinoids. So we'll continue to see the minors be recognized and show up in the primary literature. As far as Delta 8 goes, I mean, that is probably one of the hottest topics, especially in states where cannabis isn't legal, right? It's potentially a means for individuals to access the effects of Delta 9, but legally, right? And so we just had actually a buddy of ours on our podcast a little while ago talking about these exact situations, right? And so I think the DEA said that Delta 8 or synthetic cannabinoids are now illegal, right? So cannabinoid analogs might have been the exact term that they used, correct?
I was going to say, yeah, I think the language was, it was four bullet points that the DEA put forward, and one of the bullet points was specific to saying that any synthetic is illegal. But the question was, you know, does that include an isometric process that still takes an organic cannabinoid and just does a modification of that cannabinoid? Or was that that bullet point really geared towards, you know, K2 and spice and other things that are, you know, coming out of Chinese factories that are adulterating, you know, the original chemical composition of THC Delta 9 in favor of coming out with something that's a true synthetic? And so I think that, you know, the way the IFR was written, the interim final rule that DEA put out was written, it didn't give true clarity as to the intent of what they were writing. So I think right now the interpretation is still relatively open, and people are trying to figure it out. So I'm curious to see kind of, you know, Larry and I are both attorneys, unfortunately. So we think about things in a very specific way, but it's always interesting for us to see, you know, kind of what people on the ground are thinking about in terms of how they look at the ruling, what the legal guidance they've gotten is, and you know, what your thoughts are about, you know, crossing state lines with D8 in light of the DEA's ruling and in light of just the way the language was drafted.
I think in those situations, it's always best to defer to someone like yourself to kind of make sure that you're handling things the right way. From our side, the D8's a common question, especially for me here in New York. I get friends and family all the time asking about, hey, can I get this product? Will it get me high? And it's like, well, yes. And they're like, is it illegal? And then you're like, well, depends, like what's going on here. And that's where it really becomes kind of like that gray area. And that's really a unique situation. And I wonder too, Robert, like what you were saying was, why did it become such a hot topic? And for me, I believe it's really going to be a short-term fad as these kind of states come online. And then I wonder over time, if it becomes one of those combinations where it's suited towards a certain goal, maybe the combination of some terpenes and DEA with some other minor cannabinoids hits a targeted goal after some kind of research and scientific evidence comes out.
You don't think there'll be a long-term market for it as kind of like the light beer market of cannabis? You know, I think about it from the perspective of, you know, there's a lot of people that are new to the category that are kind of a little bit frightened of using cannabis for the whole idea that they've been fed that this isn't your grandparents' cannabis. This isn't, you know, 1970s weed of 5% THC content. You know, now people are growing things that are coming in at, you know, 30% THC. So, you know, I'd like to use the category, but I don't necessarily want to get that high. And is D8, do you think, you know, going to be seen as a kind of a happy medium?
How do you communicate that information from a marketing sense? How are you going to communicate to someone that there's a difference between all these cannabinoids? It's already pretty confusing, and marketers are really struggling to associate, for example, this is for rest, this is for sleep, and ultimately, is it? It's really hard to kind of tell in those areas. I think, at least from the short-term approach, the two-to-ones, the two CBD to the one THC is probably the best approach to kind of communicating the basics. You don't want to get too stoned. Maybe go with the two-to-one approach, which allows you kind of feel that nice, mellow high, but also that comfortable, relaxed feeling you might be looking for.
So at the end of the day, I mean, you guys are like, you know, the early alchemists, right? You're the ones who are sitting in the back fiddling with these plants and, you know, trying to come up with different cannabinoids that you can pull out. A cultivator's just growing the weed and everything else. It's you guys who are really sitting there and always looking for new ways to unlock it. D8 comes out. You know, I know that on the one of the big things that we at the Hoban Law Group were talking about with our clients on the hemp side is, what do you do with the fact that all of a sudden you've got hemp that spikes really high in THCA, right? Which we all know the minute you light it up, it's going to convert and you're going to catch a buzz. But right now it's hemp, so it's 0.3% or less because they're only looking at the D9 levels. You know, there's people out there, obviously, who are taking the time, you know, to figure all of this out. And one of the questions I've always had is, can guys such as yourselves, given what you have to work with, have the ability to keep up with, let's say, if, you know, Big Pharma finally comes online and can get its hands on cannabis, you can really start digging down deep and unlocking, you know, some of these secrets of the plant that we may not have even discovered yet.
Competing with Big Pharma is never a great approach, but also the same can be said for some of these smaller processors and cultivators that are trying to compete with some of the big MSOs. At the end of the day, the industry is evolving and there's market shares for everyone. There's there's craft brews and then there's major brew companies. We advise our clients, especially as the industry evolves, is to maybe double down on your niche, find out exactly what you're looking to accomplish. And that's the fortified building that you're building from your moat standpoint. And ultimately, what might come along for some of our partners in some of these other states is exactly what's happened in Florida, where, you know, Cresco went in there and they wanted to be involved and they purchased wellness.
Right. Right.
Let me just piggyback one more thing on that, Pharma. Yeah. I think there's one important point to make there. As far as utilizing cannabinoids as a medicine, so if we're referring to, say, Delta 8 as a potential API that's going to be used to cure illnesses, I think that Big Pharma should be the only ones responsible for the manufacturing of those kind of use cases, right? And it's strictly because the tools that they have in their facilities are designed to produce pure products with no byproducts. A lot of what the Delta 8 that's coming online in the marketplace is being done by garage chemists who aren't, there's a ton of byproducts associated with the synthetic products, right? And so that's why you can see a giant rainbow of colors when you're shopping around for Delta 8 on the wholesale market, right? And so
in
I just thought
of residual
that,
solvents.
I don't think they're residual solvents. They are other byproducts of the chemical, of the catalyst that are being added. They are byproducts from alternative mechanisms that are being executed, right? So it's not a perfect catalyst, and there's going to be a bunch of different byproducts, and a lot of those byproducts can be hid in the.
So that kind of begs the question, you know, and I don't disagree with you, but the question then is this best left to the biosynthetics and the industrial agriculture guys that are, you know, creating cannabinoids in the lab and then are, you know, producing them with contract manufacturing organizations with DEA controlled substances permits? Or is it something that's going to be ultimately better off being done in a cultivation room than using, you know, HPLC to do the extraction or, you know, do an extraction process and then put it through a chromatographic system? You know, as you said, there's a lot of byproducts in the extraction process or can be. Would it not just be smarter to start off with a building block like yeast or E. coli or sucrose?
I think that is the best way to start. And the technology is coming online soon, right? Like Kronos Group, they invested a bunch of money in the biosynthetic route. And
Ginkgo,
They're developing right now, and it'll come online, and it will be the best option when you're utilizing like a Delta 8 or another miner that is, you would have to grow an insane amount of biomass to be able to extract it. That utilizing yeast in those routes is probably the best way to go about it. And then I'm only strictly speaking to the miners. I mean, when you can get enough of, say, CBG, right, out of the plant, it should be pulled out of the plant. But when you have to now start adding additional chemicals and some of these really toxic catalysts that are being used to try to convert it over, I think that that's where you end up potentially doing more harm to the consumer and to the industry than is worth the good that could potentially come from it.
Well, our guests today have been Brian Felds and Kellen Finney from Eighth Revolution. They've provided us with a lot of interesting information. Before we pivot away to the music side, guys, just really quickly let our listeners know how they can get in touch with you. If you have a web page, what's the best way to do it? If you're on social media, so that they can follow you or reach out and connect with you.
Sure. So we're pretty out there on social media. Both of us have Twitter handles. Mine's Brian Fields 24, and Kellen's is a little more complicated to memorize. And from a company perspective, it's eighthrev.com, the number 8threv.com. And on a monthly basis, we put together a monthly playbook, which is just kind of an aggregation of current research documents, pricing, technology, and forward-thinking approaches, which is a way for us to kind of work with our clients that we don't speak to every single day and maybe have a concept that might be of value to them. And it's roughly about 25 pages that we put together in a way to kind of have a forward-thinking approach of just the pulse of the industry. And it's just our way of kind of communicating, you know, vantage points and concepts that we're seeing. And, you know, what really that could mean to the future of the industry.
Okay. Well, very good, guys. Thank you. You are free to stick around for a few minutes as we pivot over to music. The other side of our show that we like to spend a few minutes on is live music jam band with a particular emphasis on the Grateful Dead and Dead-related music. Talking with you guys in advance, Brian, it sounds like you haven't quite broached that barrier yet, but Kellen, I understand that you had an opportunity to see Dead & Company.
I did. I got to see them on their farewell show in San Jose, so it was a good time.
Oh, when they did that, the 50-year anniversary stuff when they played a couple of shows out there.
A year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, 2019?
Yeah.
Right?
2015.
Oh, no, 2015. Yeah, totally.
2015. Wow. Yeah, I saw the three shows in Chicago, but I did not see the shows in Rob, I know you were in Chicago. Did you also see the California shows?
I didn't, because it was only announced as one show initially, and then they added the second show. And at that point, if they'd announced the two to begin with, I probably would have gone out for both. But it was a last-minute edition of the Friday night.
Well, I had some friends who were out at that shows, and they had the big rainbow one night over the stadium. And it was really cool and everything. And truthfully, from my perspective, I forgot which night it was, the first or second night out there, was the night they did their whole late 1960s stuff. And that was really the show I wanted to see more than any of the other shows. I liked everything. The three shows we saw were great. But I've always been particularly tuned into that psychedelic side, the really heavy. I love the 25-minute Dark Stars. It's a good place to be sometimes.
Right?
I remember that night, Larry, really well, because I wasn't in San Jose. I was actually in Denver at the Four Seasons, and I was hanging out with Christian Cederberg from Vicente Cederberg. And and the two of us were in the lobby when I got the picture sent to me of the rainbow from the Friday night show with the whole sky just pink and amazing. And we sat there and passed it around for everyone else to see. So there's like 20 of us that were just hanging out at the bar. And it was all cannabis guys, a lot of deadheads. And Chris and I were both going out to Chicago the next week. So it was pretty cool to be sitting there like, all right, we're in for it. This is going to be awesome. But that was just like, one of those things where you sat there looking at a picture in real time, wishing you were there.
Absolutely. Well, Kellen, before you went to those shows, had you followed the Dead at all? What got you to go to those shows?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd always kind of like dabbled in the Dead and those kind of things. But when I was actually out in California, the owners of the company that I was working for, they are huge, huge Dead fans and been to every show. They're in their like mid 40s, older gentlemen, and they were like, we have to go. Like, we rented the Airbnb, they took the whole company down there. It was pretty cool to be able to like go to a show with like just hardcore fans, lifelong fans, had been to so many shows. My boss ended up like going to the ones in Chicago and like went to every single one because he's like, I have to, you know what I mean? So it was cool to get to go with those kind of with those big of fans.
As an older gentleman, yes, I absolutely know what you mean. And that's always been the fun of it. And that's what got me into it, 35, 40 years ago now almost, when we first started going to see him, was just the opportunity to hang with like-minded people and, the opportunity to know that every night you were going in to see a show, you just had no freaking idea what it was going to be. And, Jerry could fall flat on his face or he could come and raise the roof. And, you were always there because if he raised the roof, you didn't want to miss it. And if he fell flat on his face, you were willing to take that chance just not to miss him raising the roof. So, for me, it just became a way of life for a while. And it's been nice because at this age in my life, it still has a lot of carryover, particularly because of the fact that it's become multi-generational. And my kids, who range between 18 and 30, have now all, after, yelling at me for years, because every road trip we ever took, I forced them, to listen to Grateful Dead all the way there and back. Now they can't get enough of it. They go to see the Dead, they go to see Fish, and they love it. And it makes me feel good because I got to tell you, my dad had a whole case full of records, not one that I ever had any interest in listening to. He and I had, we never saw a concert together, never any of that kind of stuff. But with a band like the Dead, you can do that. And so that's really a lot of fun. Brian, what's your musical choice when you have some free time and you want to listen to something?
I'm all over the place. So anything from the alternative to kind of the DJ, I really let Spotify just play whatever it thinks, and it just runs continuously throughout the day, and just wherever it goes, it goes.
Which, you know, look, is a good way to do it too. And every now and then, when I've deaded out and I just need something for a change, I'll do that, or I'll go on Pandora or one of them and just hit play for a little while and see what it spits out at me. And every now and then, you never know, it couldn't be something, couldn't be something that you really like to see. Brian, you're located in New York.
I am in New York. So for a while I worked at Madison Square Garden, where I got to attend a ton of really cool concerts and get exposed to just types of music that I've never got to see. The best experience I had was the History of Rock and Roll concert I got to go to, which had like the biggest names of all of them. And just, I didn't understand at the time what I was witnessing, but seeing some of like the largest acts like share a stage together and just like play each other's songs was just an incredible experience.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Okay. Rob, what do you hear about our boys? Anything in the offing anytime soon? You know, I know Bobby and the Wolf Brothers did their New Year's thing, which is always fun, and we listened to a little bit of it, but I have to confess that we had been listening to Fish earlier in the evening, and then we listened to Bobby for a few minutes, but I quickly pivoted over to the Goodbye to Winterland album, and which is one of my favorite New Year's shows of all time, and I'm always happy to come back to that once a year at New Year's Eve.
Yeah, no, I think we've talked about it before. The closing of the Winterland is pretty amazing, with 8 hours of music and everyone getting served champagne and pancakes in the morning. Not a bad way to end a venue. I think what we've seen in the last, you know, recent time, I don't think there's been too much in the way of live music happening. I think all of us are chomping at the bit to get back out there and start seeing some shows again. But obviously, you know, Trey did a really nice thing with those Beacon shows, which I know you covered quite a bit on this. And then it's a question of, you know, are we going to start seeing some more collaborations going into the period of, I think what we're now seeing again is another, you know, kind of light at the end of the tunnel, much like, you know, Cannabis Prohibition ending. I think that we're now hopefully seeing, you know, Biden's charge of 100 million vaccine doses in the next 100 days. And, you know, if that's the case and we keep up at that pace, I think that live music is probably in the cards by the end of the summer. So I think we're all waiting to see, and I would expect that, you know, everyone in the dead is waiting to get back out there and start playing shows again.
Well, it seems to me that everyone in the music industry is chomping at the bit. I just read today that Jazz Fest has announced October of this year. Instead of their traditional end of April, May, they're going to do 2 weekends in October. And they, you know, they say they're very optimistic that they're going to be able to do it and go forward. And, you know, I'm going to be a little more circumspect until I see numbers shift a little bit, but I think it's great that people are at least thinking about it and getting some ideas out there, because you know, that'll be the best thing of all in terms of, you know, getting people back to some sense of normalcy, right? Is being able to go out and see music and congregate with other folks. And Dr. Fauci, whether you like him or not, says that if the vaccines work and if everything goes in the right direction, that, you know, large scale concerts by this fall are not out of the question. So, you know, that's also a little positive light there and something to look forward to.
Well, I'm feeling encouraged right now. My in-laws both got vaccinated with their first dose today, which is just great news. And I'm still waiting to hear whether my mom gets hers in Florida. But, you know, I know enough people now where, you know, people they're close to have gotten their first dose of vaccine. So, you know, again, I think Fauci was saying that it takes probably north of 80 million people in this country to get the vaccination to really start making a real dent in this, so you can start feeling a bit more safe. But, you know, if you were to say, what are you most looking forward to? You know, I think this next year's New Year's is going to be one of the biggest celebrations of any New Year's, simply because every band in the world is going to be back out there playing. And I think every music lover is going to be back out there seeing them play. So what does that mean for the dead community? You know, I think that you don't have people that are as hardcore about seeing shows as often as members of, you know, kind of like the jam band or Grateful Dead family or community. So with that in mind, I'd expect that almost every iteration you can think of every, you know, kind of touring act is going to start being back out there playing shows just as fast as they can possibly do it once people feel safe to get back out there.
Yeah, me too. And that'll be great. That'll be something really nice to look forward to. I've just about made my way through all of my Dick's picks and Dave's picks and Europe 72 and all the live dead I have lying around the house. And I can always start over again if I have to, but it's always nice to to get outside and see some real news stuff for a while there and see what's going on.
You know, you say that, Larry, but at the same time, like, I've rediscovered so many shows that I haven't listened to in years as a result of not having anything new to go see. So, you know, my mountain bike and my headphones are kind of fully attached to me these days, and I'm on archive.org, you know, picking out different things, and I'll pick an era and say, okay, like, let me think about, you know, five shows I can see from, you know, spring of 83 and just, you know, to catch different styles and different variations. And, you know, you and I know that I'm a total geek about certain, like, iterations about, you know, how a certain phrase is played and whether it's only played this way in, you know, 79 or it's only played this way. And so, you know, getting back and actually, like, really geeking out on Grateful Dead music again has been really fun before they start playing some new stuff. So,
I agree. Well, it was like was it last year or the year before when they released the tour, the 77, May of 77 with Barton Hall. And, you know, Barton Hall's the greatest show, and it is a great show. And there was a time when I listened to it all the time, but I hadn't really listened to it in years. And I put Barton Hall on it, like, from the very first note of the very first song, right away you were like, oh, yeah. Yeah, this concert, this is going to be great. And by the time they got to the morning dew at the end where, you know, Jerry blows the roof off the joint, I mean, it's just a big love fest. I mean, you just can't beat it. And it's great to rediscover it again. And it was funny, on the radio yesterday or the other day, I heard, I listen to Fish Radio sometimes, and unlike the Dead station on XM on Fish, they have a DJ. They only have a small number of them. They're always rotating around. But she was talking about, we're going to be playing for you a show later on, and the second set is great. It has a number of type 2 jams.
Right.
What's a type 2 jam? A type 2 jam is when you're in the middle of the jam and you turn to your buddy and you say, what song are they playing again? Type 2.
And it's also one where multiple musicians are soloing. It's not just a guitar solo, but whereas multiple people are all in the pocket and going their separate ways before they bring it back together again. So, yep. You know, like in type 2 jamming, I think is one of those phrases that only people that are, you know, jam band fans would ever, you know, use, because everyone else is so composed as far as, you know, like on the indie scene. Yeah, I'm a huge indie fan as well. But, you know, every single time an indie band plays a song, it's going to time in within like a second or two of how it was written. Whereas, you know, with type 1 jamming, you know, you might actually have an extended period of time where the guitar, you know, plays a longer solo. But with type 2, it's just mayhem. You know,
and that's, you know, and that was always the best. And, you know, this is, I think, like, where my kids had the hardest time. And, you know, when I say that, I don't mean to, like, you know, be patronizing to you guys, but you're more closer to the age of my kids than you are to me. But, you know, for them, and I think the hardest part about anybody adapting into it is really understanding the power of the jam, you know, and it's great to have the lyrics and it's great to be able to sing along with the song that you know. But what does make it so special, you're right, Rob, or you know, and you, boy, by God, you can listen to, you know, Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's Tower through five different eras of the Dead, and you'll hear very distinct different ways that they play it and different things that they're doing. And you can hear that with all of their stuff. And I just see that as evidence of them growing over time, which is what always kept them relevant. Because, I mean, if Scarlet Fire sounded like Scarlet Fire the exact same way every single time, it would be great to see. But after a while, it would be Scarlet Fire. But the fact that on any given night, you didn't know if it was going to be Scarlet Fire, or was it going to be Scarlet something else, or was it going to this or that? And was Jerry going to remember the words, for God's sakes? I mean, you know, there was just so many variables that went into it that gave you that feeling that, who knows?
So my question for you is, with the inauguration today, you know, what song kind of typifies the American feeling, you know, for the Grateful Dead? Like, would you pick a U.S. blues or would you pick a Liberty? You know, what would you go as far as, you know, thinking about just kind of what a new administration means and, you know, just politics in America today?
Good question. I can't pick Liberty. You know, Liberty is one of those litmus test songs, I think, for some people. And what I find is a lot of the newer, younger Deadheads really, really love it. I know that the band claims to love it and think it's one of their Jerry and Robert Hunter's finest works. It never clicked for me in my crowd. And, you know, Liberty, we maybe not quite in the same category as Day Job, but it just never really... It never really took off for us. I kind of pushed that off to the side. I love U.S. Blues. I think it's a great tune. It's a little bit irreverent, and, you know, maybe a little bit of irreverence is what we need right now, you know. Summertime done, come and gone, my oh my, you know, maybe Trump's time now, come and gone, my oh my. You could substitute that in there for it. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm just going to, you know, probably throw on a nice, you know, circa 1968, 69 Viola Lee Blues, and, you know, just crank it up to full volume, and, you know, just feel like I'm just letting it wash over me, and, you know, get those bad vibes out of the way. And I will tell you, that's the one jam tune I really wish they would have kept playing. There was no lyrics. Jerry had nothing to do but go out and play his guitar for 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a fair amount of catharsis around the country tonight, no matter how people choose to celebrate. You know, there's obviously a lot of people that are pretty upset by, you know, today's results as well. But I think for those that have been, you know, collectively holding their breath for the last 4 years, there's a pretty big national exhale that's happening today.
True. And I'll tell you, I you know, again, I'm not here to talk politics, but yeah. I think, you know, it's hard to just miss the basic facts that 4 years ago at this time, you know, there was a whole group of us sitting around really worrying, do we even have it tomorrow? You know, is this guy crazy enough to go push a button and all of a sudden, you know, life as we know it has come to an end? And he didn't. Okay, to his credit, I guess. I don't have that feeling with, you know, with Biden. 5 minutes into Biden talking, I'm like, right, this is what an American president sounds like.
Yeah.
He's caring and he talks to the people. And to me, look, any Republican who would have been president the last 4 years would have probably put in a lot of the same policies, appointed the same judges. But I wouldn't have walked around with like this fear in my heart and this, you know, this big lump in my stomach the whole time, you know, so worried and so afraid. I wasn't a Ronald Reagan fan, but when he spoke, he reminded me of my grandfather. It was almost comforting to listen to him talk. Not so with Donald Trump, but Biden today, 5 minutes into it, you're like, oh yeah, you know, this is a guy who connects with the American people and really cares about them. And I believe him when he says that he does want to be the president for all people, and he's not going to decide what state gets the vaccine based on whether or not they voted for him.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it's a great excuse to wean myself off of a huge Twitter addiction. You know, spend far too much time, you know, checking things to see like what the news of the minute is, because things change so fast. And, you know, I never cease to be amazed. And every time where I was like, you know, this will, you know, can you believe this happened? And finally, I hit a point, you know, about 3 years into it where I said, yeah, I can believe all of it. You know, nothing surprises me anymore. But then it was just watching for, you know, if there's anything even crazier than the last. So now I feel, you know, not just the catharsis of a changing of the guard, just, you know, where I feel that the country hopefully can start to heal a little bit. But from the perspective, there's so many people, I think, that are going to be far more productive because they've got a lot less time to worry. So if it's right. If it's the ability now to listen to more music, or if it's the ability to go out there and spend more time with your kids, or go out there and, you know, go hiking or biking or do other stuff that's more productive. I look forward to a lot of the people that were just glued to their televisions, glued to their news sources, to kind of say, okay, I don't think, you know, we have as much to you know, get outraged about right now. You know, sure, on the right, there's going to be a lot of policies they're not going to like on the left, but I don't think it's going to be, as you said, with the same amount of bombast as we saw before.
Right. And that's, you know, so much with an eye towards, you wonder if he's really trying to hurt other people and all of that. But here's what I'd say in closing, because I realize that we have been going on maybe in a little bit past our time, thanks to our good guests today and interesting topics to talk about. But we all have relationships with people on both sides of the aisle. So if you're a Republican, yeah, there's Democrats, you know, and your family and friends, Democrats, you're Republicans, you know, and, you know, we all talk about a time for healing, and everybody has to heal in their own way. And I get that. And I don't expect Republicans to come running in today and say, oh, Joe Biden is the bomb and we're all with him. But we do have to find a way to be able to talk to each other once again. And I would just very, very humbly suggest to our listeners and that they share with their friends and family and everyone out there that the best and easiest way to do that when you're in that crowd is to pull out a joint and light it up and wait for the first, you know, you're a Democrat, wait for the first Republican to come over and say, what strain is that? And the minute they ask you that question, you guys, that's it. You've connected. The political issues kind of fall to the side, because he's going to say, oh, yeah, well, I got a guy who lives out in Humboldt, and he grows this strain, and he's going to pull a joint out of his pocket. And before you know it, everybody's sitting around getting high. Hopefully you forgot what got you upset in the first place. And if you're really, really lucky, you come across some 8th Revolution stuff, and everybody goes home with a big smile on their face. So
Again, we talked about a lot. Cannabis and music are the two equalizers in so many different things. And if there's anything that unites people, smoking weed and listening to good music usually gets the job done.
Amen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amen. Once again, big shout out and thank you to Brian Felds and Kellen Finney of Eighth Revolution for being with us today. Guys, one more time, just give us the website where our listeners can get a hold of you.
It would be Eighth Rev, and I can provide the information in the show notes as well. And we've got a 10-minute podcast we call The Dime, where we dive into current events and topics. We talked about the Georgia, we talked about D8, and it's hot takes only. So it's a really quick dive, and kind of pay homage to it with the name of The Dime.
Well, excellent. Hopefully our listeners will make their way over there and be able to do that. So thank you to you guys today for joining us. Special shout out and thank you to my new co-host, Rob Hunt. Rob, it's great to have you on the show and welcome to the team.
Thanks, Larry. And thanks, Brian and Callum, for joining us today, guys.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate the time.
Sure. And finally, a shout out to my other co-host, Jim Marty, who cannot be with us today. Hopefully he's traveling home safely from Oregon and will be back to join us next week with wonderful stories of what took place up in the state of Oregon. Until then, for all of our readers, listeners, this is Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group. Thank you for tuning in today. Enjoy. And when you enjoy your cannabis, please do so responsibly. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.